easiest.
So I was going to ask about the about your contemporaries at the law school. Did you make a bond with them immediately? Did you stay friends with them for a long time?
With a certain number we did. For instance, Dodie and I stayed friends. Yes, we stayed, and we still are. We still are. We don't see a lot of each other. One thing is driving. You know, she doesn't drive at night anymore. I don't drive at night anymore. So, but we still. Not that much, because everybody sort of went in their own direction to busy trying to find articles. Articles were very difficult to find in 1952 when I graduated. And believe me, they were difficult to find for a woman. I don't mind saying that. They were particularly... You know, and I had the other problem that the large firms, yes, and there's no problem. I could have gone to Russell Dumoulin, but the large firms didn't pay very much, and I needed enough money to support myself. Mm-hmm. And because at that stage, I really wasn't able to work that much anymore, and so I finally ended up with. After knocking on a lot of doors, with a single practitioner, a man by the name of Ernest Silverton. And I got an incredible amount of experience with dealing with a lot of people. He had a lot of clients. He was not a particularly efficient lawyer. Terrible pleadings. Oh, I remember Mr. Justice Manson calling me into his chambers, and I thought, oh dear, what have I done now? And he said to me, don't use Ernie's pleadings. They're terrible, he says. You make. Get in touch with one of the large firms, Bullhauser, or one of the large firms, and Davis and Company, and get them to send you a proper precedent for that type of action. And he says, because his precedents are absolutely hopeless, you know.
Why were they so bad?
He just wasn't a paper lawyer. He was a lawyer that he had more clients than, like, if I told you, he was always running with about 2,500 active files. The man was so busy, but he was always in about 8 different directions. He owned a motel on Kingsway. He owned a theater. He was building his new house, and he was trying to look after a single practitioner, a law practice. Well, he paid me quite well in terms of what others were paying, but literally I was running his office with two secretaries that resented the hell out of me because I was going to be the lawyer, you know, and they had worked for years, and often they terribly resented me. It wasn't wasn't the best of time, let's put it that way, but I stayed, and I used to come in, and I'd look after his room would be sitting full of people, and I'd say, where's Mr. Silverton? Oh, he dashed out, we're not sure where he is, and it's true. And he would be over talking to the contractor in West Vancouver who was building his house, and I'd get him on the phone, and I'd guess that's where he would be, and I'd get him, and he'd come in, and I can tell you, he'd clear the office of 35 people so quickly, but he'd tell them nothing, literally. I certainly learned how not to practice law. he was an absolute genius of handling people. They loved him. But I'd be on my wit's end every day waiting for something to go wrong, you know, a date to be missed, mm-hmm. or something that I didn't know or wasn't told about and it would happen. And because he had no diary system. He had everything in his head. And as his law student, I'd be sent up to court with, he'd be handing me a back of files for Chambers. I wouldn't have seen any of them. And some of the files, I had to look and find out, who the heck are we acting for here? Are we for the plaintiff? Or can you imagine?
It sounds like a nightmare scenario.
It was a nightmare. It was, I can tell you.
Being unprepared for something.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you see, there was never any time to prepare because he'd hand you this stuff, you know, literally. And I'd be racing up to the courthouse with these files. And we had some judges, I think of particularly Judge Klein.
Is that J.V. Klein?
J.V. Klein, absolutely. That's J.V. Klein, who didn't have a whole lot of time for law students anyway, or article clerks, I should say. He didn't have a lot of time for them. And the room would be crowded. Chambers was entirely sort of a different process. The room was everybody was in the one small room, and your case would be called, and you'd be in the door. You couldn't get yourself through the crowd to get up, and if he didn't hear you, he'd dismiss your application. You know, oh yeah, he was not a nice man, not a nice man.
What was Silverton's background?
He was Estonian, and a hardworking guy. There's no doubt about it. A very hardworking guy, but got into doing too many things, and ultimately, he moved to the United States. Ultimately, after not too long after I did my articles and I saw him in the States, he became a lawyer in the United States. That's all I can really tell you, that he was an Estonian.
Had he been at UBC Law?
Yes, I think he was, yes. I think he was a UBC graduate. He was married, had a wife that was a nurse, had two daughters. I think one of the daughters became a lawyer in the United States. Really nice man, but just not organized. Truly a lawsuit waiting to happen.
So you learned how not to...
I learned how, you very definitely learned how not to practice law. He was generous with people. There was an old chap that came in, I can remember his name, Mr. Mackinac, an old fellow, used to come in, and he would pick up $10-$20. He had no money, so Silverton would reach in his pocket and he'd tell him to, here, go and get something to eat. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of generosity. He was terribly generous in that way. But no bookkeeper. So then, of course, needless to say, the tax department came in, and the files were in. And I was sitting there trying to dig up these files and trying to tell them what was going on in those files, and I had absolutely no idea because there was nothing in the file, maybe something written on the file cover. That's the way. And I say it was a lawsuit waiting to happen.
But obviously, you must have impressed him at the interview or whatever you had.
I have an idea he himself had had a struggle, mm-hmm. in getting himself established. Mm-hmm. And I think he recognized that I had literally tramped out the city and a lot of the several, I think of one particular man, who said, oh no, law student, you should be paying us to take you. You know, that was kind of the attitude. So articles was not an easy thing to find. And the pay, I was probably one of the upper paid, and I was paid $100 a month. Okay, but firms like Russell Dumoulin were paying $40 and $45, large firms, and this was 1952, 53. And that was sort of standard.
Hmm. Where was the office?
Downtown, 615 West Pender.
How long were you there?
I was there with him for my full article period. And I was called to the bar. And
shortly after he went off to the United States, and I thought, this is a good place to stay in this building. Actually, I stayed in his premise, a chunk of it. I rented just a chunk of it. My uncle came in, and he and I built partitions and for a piece of it. Oh, yeah, literally. Okay. Literally, my uncle, who was, like my father, very handy with the hammer. He's, oh, you know, we'll sort Joe. And we had, oh, yeah, we did at a nice small office, a private office in my secretary's office. But these people were used to that building, that floor, that, and I was able to gather up a lot of his clients, and he had a lot of Estonian clients, and they were all builders in the city, and I really, really snagged a lot of them.
How did you retain them? I mean, I don't know the process.
Well, they a lot of them came looking for him. He didn't tell anybody he was going any place. He just went. And a lot of them would come in looking for him. And then word of mouth, he was gone. And I had one fellow came in, a very, very quiet man, spoke very poor English, and I must have impressed him because he passed the word along, and before I knew it, I had Estonians that were all builders or bricklayers, you know, all in that type of business. Mm-hmm. And they were excellent clients, absolutely excellent. They were honest as the day is long. They did, you know, they took advice, they paid their bills. And pretty soon my clientele built up otherwise as well. But that's how that started. And it just built up from 19. I was out on my own from when the time I was called to the bar, I opened my own office. I always had this vision of seeing my name in gold letters. And I said to my uncle, first thing I need is I need my name in gold letters on some glass, you know, and this sort of frosted glass, that's what I need. And he said, that's what you will have. And I tell you how I started. Mm-hmm. My principal, Silverton, his brother-in-law was a bank manager at the Toronto Dominion Bank at Maine and Hastings. There's these crazy things I remember. And he said, you need some money. I said, yeah, I've got to go and talk to some bankers and hopefully get some money. And I started with $500 bank loan. And this fellow is his brother-in-law. I can't even remember his name at the moment. He said, sure. He says, on Ernie's recommendation, I'll give you $500. He says, I'll even give you a little more. And he said, don't worry about getting it back. I said, no. I said, that's going to be paid back as quickly as I can. And I had that paid back within, and lived within 2 years. I was making sufficient money to keep myself going. And I was there then. I moved across the street to 626 West Pender into better accommodation. I then shared there. I shared accommodation with a fellow that I went through law school with. He had an old senior. And the old fellow retired, and he came across me. He says, Pat, why don't you come and share space with me? So I shared space with Hugh Evans, and we had enough room for both our secretaries. My secretary came with me, and we had a great relationship in the Royal Trust Building. It was a Royal Trust Building, 626 West Pender. And from there, I moved up closer to the courthouse. Now, where the Wedgwood Hotel is, the Wedgwood Hotel was known as the Mayfair Tower. It had offices on the first two floors, and the rest were apartments. My office was on the second floor, which is now the marketing office for the Wedgwood Hotel. And of course, the old courthouse was just across the street, and that's where I stayed practicing till I was appointed to the provincial court in 1971.
What was your firm called? Was it just?
I shared myself. I shared space there again with a fellow by the name of Burnett, Ken Burnett, I think was his name. And then for about eight months, I joined a group, Lakoven and Company, Lakoven Allen and Lougheed. But I only stayed with them 8 months. I was appointed to the bench.
We talked to someone who remembered that in the late 60s there was a sign in the common room at the law school that said no women allowed.
Interesting.
Well, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but you've already mentioned it was difficult.
Articling was difficult. Yes, I don't remember any difficulty at the law school. Maybe because there was about two or three of us that were kind of a group. Mm-hmm. Myself, there was Glenn Gates, Dodie Holmes, Dodie Branca, and we sort of sat together and sometimes didn't pay too much attention. But I did not suffer from any. I know that I've heard complaints, but I don't remember any part of the law school. But then we didn't have a lounge. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, we were in the huts. There was no lounge, so yeah. They couldn't have kicked us out of anything until they got to the new building. Mm-hmm. And everybody was so excited. I don't think anybody noticed whether it was women or men around. You know, I just don't think they don't. I don't recall any. Mm-hmm. No, that was not. I don't remember any difficulty with race or, any sort of prejudice of any mm-hmm. kind. No, I don't. And
It seems like you had quite a practical approach.
I did.
And a practical exposure with Silverton.
I really saw, let me put it this, I saw law being practiced at the very ground roots, you know, just at the very level of people with the most fundamental problems. People come in with the most the oddest simple problems, and people that were uneducated, poor, and he didn't turn anybody away. And for that, he may have been not had the best pleadings, but he had a heart the size of a mountain. The guy was all heart in terms of people. And if there's nothing else he taught me that there's people everywhere that need to be looked after, and you don't care what color they are or what religion they are or what language they speak, they have to be looked after. It doesn't matter what. I remember going down to court, to the provincial court, to get a drug addict. We had a family that he knew the parents, and they had kids that were into drugs. And this one kid, oh my God, he was such a mess with drugs, and I didn't want to be near that kid. But he said, he's a human being, and you go down there and you get an adjournment. I said, I don't want to be next to him. I said, he must have diseases. I told him, and afterwards, I came back when he asked the secretaries, where's Pam? Oh, I said, she went home. What do you mean she went home? She went home to take a bath. But the man was, he was down to earth, and he certainly, I had learned to be tolerant of everybody and everything as a kid. We had, during the war, we had Japanese, we had a Japanese gardener. We had Japanese move in from the coast or moved into the interior. And we had Japanese all around us, and they were in my home, and I was in their home. And we had Indians above where we lived, above the hill, a very large Indian family lived.
and we were in their homes. We so.
So there was a
race
tolerance.
Never. There was a total tolerance. We were Catholics. They up the street, there were Anglicans. You know, there was people with no religion. Didn't bother us. We were just taught that way. And I say I was fortunate in my articles that again I was taught that everybody's a human being and everybody needs to be treated like one. And you know, it stuck with me. Yes, and I guess a lot of when I was appointed, as my CV tells you, there I was the first in the. Women had the one thing they did with women, there's no doubt about that, they had a tendency to appoint them to the family court out on Yale Street. Lorraine Johnson was there. What was her name, the first one? Patterson, I think, was first. And then there was Winnie Murphy. And that's where I was appointed to begin with, family court, in November. I was there a month, and I thought, this is not the way I'm going to spend the rest of my life in court. This is, you know, I'm not going to sorting out. It was called juvenile and family, bad kids, you know, and breaking and entering and women laying assault charges on the Saturday night and then coming to withdraw them on the Monday. This is not my this is. So I got in touch with Eckert, who was our administrative judge, and I said, I want to come down to 222 Main Street, I think was the provincial court. And I said, that was the criminal court. And I said, I want to do criminal court. No woman had ever been there. And in terms of a judge. And he said, why not? You start January, you'll be on the rota for January 2nd or 3rd, whatever it was. And I was immediately put in courtroom 5, Courtroom 5 was a security court, which means that most of the people were in custody. And that's where I was literally thrown in the deep end. But nobody there. When I came to that, there was only one judge that made the remark, I'll not forget it as long as I live, made the remark, well, now we've got somebody to sew the buttons on our vests. I'll never forget that. And I'm not sure that he was really, I'm not sure that, because getting to know him afterwards, I'm not sure that he was really being discriminated, but just made him sort of an offhand remark that he didn't remember. But anyway, I looked at him and I said, hey, you got a wife? If you haven't got a wife, you got a girlfriend. She can sew. And I just went and poured my coffee and, you know, ignored it. Other than that, just to remind, and you know what? I never, there was not a word afterwards. I had nothing but the best of relations with the judges there. Absolutely no problem at all. But I don't take offense to the very sort of this minor stuff that everybody, I don't take offense to that. I ignore lots of it. I tell myself, just rise above it. This is, you know, I just don't get myself into a, I don't know, I guess women maybe wouldn't agree with me, but you know, a lot of this big issues made out of stuff that's small and unimportant. You know, one has to look at the big picture as to what's going on and never mind all this small stuff. As I say, I don't. So I must say, I guess I ignored a lot of it. Maybe there was some of it around. Maybe there wasn't. I certainly didn't feel any of it, and I sure didn't feel that I was being discriminated against. I was assigned the same cases as everybody else. I did. I was on the rota in the same way. They had a system there where you were assigned to a particular courtroom for a month. For a month you'd do impaired driving charges. For a month you'd do, get very boring after a while. For a month you'd do, this was, you have to appreciate much before the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So we did cases like you wouldn't believe. A murder trial would take 3 or 4 days and that kind of thing, you know, because you didn't have all these issues. You know, if a statement was voluntary, it took you took you to Bois d'Ire for 15 minutes to find out whether it was voluntary. So we did, yeah, and you might do three impaired driving cases in one day. We had a courtroom that did nothing but soliciting cases, prostitution, and we would do six cases a day, easily. So
it was speedier than it is now.
Oh my God, yes. Oh Lord, yes. The courts are so bogged down, and as important parts of the charter are, boy, it sure. Whether people like to admit it or not, in many ways it's caused chaos because the lawyers use it. They make these motions, and they have to be, oh, it's chaotic, I can tell you. And they've got to do something about it, and I don't know what they can do about it. But the trials have got to be shortened because they're too costly. Nobody can afford a lawyer anymore. However, I digress. I didn't feel anything. I came up from provincial court then when I say after I did provincial, I have really enjoyed my time. I was there from November 71. I was appointed there, and I have a hunch it was March of 74. March is in my mind because I believe the Canadian Bar or the Vancouver Bar were having a big dinner. And Otto Lang was the Minister of Justice. And there hadn't been a woman appointed to the federal system. And we had the county court at that time. This was before it merged with the Supreme Court. And I had been phoned much earlier. Someone asked me whether I was interested. And I said, yes, I might be. And then the night before that dinner, Otto Lang phoned and appointed me, and it was announced at that dinner. It must have been March 74. So that wasn't very long that I was in the provincial court, and I enjoyed provincial court. It was fast-moving. You had a lot of cases, and you didn't have to do too many written decisions. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the county court, I was on that till 77, I believe, when I went to the Supreme Court. And then, of course, in 79, when did the merger take place? I forgot. 79 or 80, we moved to the new building,
And I what was the county court?
We did most of the county court did cases above the. See, we had the small claims court, which did, and at that time, let me see, what was the limit? $1,000 or something, or there, or something, or two. I forgot what the limit was. And anything over went to the county court. And the county court did mostly criminal stuff. Mostly, and we did in county court did landlord and tenant. I'm trying to think of what else, but mostly criminal stuff. And then they realized, and of course they did. Then they had another level of. We had another level of judges called local judges of the Supreme Court, and local judges of the Supreme Court were. In the outer districts, they were not in Vancouver. They were appointed to the outside to look after. They were really on the county court, and they were local judges of the Supreme Court as well, so they could look after the Supreme Court work. Well, and then that was kind of a ridiculous situation. So they finally merged the county court with the Supreme Court, but I forgot when. That you could find out very easily. I don't remember when. We moved to the new building, the new courthouse, and it was 79 or 80. Because I remember, yes, we were looking at the building, the plans to find out where our new offices would be. But Getting to as far as any notices such as no women allowed, no, didn't have any of that in the county court. Supreme Court, I remember Sandra Day O'Connor in the Supreme Court of the United States when she was appointed to there. She was, of course, the first woman. And she said, I read this somewhere, when she walked into the lounge, she told the men she wouldn't make the coffee, she wouldn't wash their cups, and she wouldn't serve them. And I walked into the lounge and I thought of Sandra Day O'Connor, and I walked over to the coffee machine and I was nervous, you know. I came from a group of men in the provincial court to the first in the county court to another group of men to another group of men first in the Supreme Court. And these courts were all quite different. And curiously, the men were quite different. And I just walked in, said that I wouldn't make the coffee, and I copied Sandra Day O'Connor, and I didn't have any no problem at all, none at all. I absolutely had. Some of the older types had a little problem with a woman around. There's no doubt about it. They weren't really uncomfortable. They didn't really know how to handle me. And I tried to think of I could understand their discomfort, because if I were a man and had to walk into just a room of female judges, there'd be discomfort, wouldn't there? You know, there's a certain comfort level that, and yes, there. It took a while to create that same sort of comfort level. I felt at times they may be a bit constrained with what they were saying or that kind of thing, but no. But we had no problem such as that. No. None at all. Matter of fact, when I came to the Supreme Court, Nemetz was the Chief Justice, Nathan, and he was a great, great supporter of me, just an absolute super, super supporter. And there was limited space, so the judges, a lot of the judges were in the Black Tower, which is Toronto Dominion Bank, at Georgia and Howe Street, I think it is. Georgia and Howe, yes. And, not Georgia, I'm sorry, Smythe and Howe. Yeah, Smythe. And, what is it? Come on, help me.
Georgia.
I think it's Georgia. Yeah, help me, yeah. Anyway, we called it the Black Tower, and a lot of the judges were in there, and they had to share a bathroom, and the Met said, oh, I can't send you. And I was appointed, can't send you over there. No, that's an impossibility. We have to find you other space. Well, there wasn't any other space. Poor old Hinkson, Mr. Justice Hinkson, lost his space because he had one of the chambers that had a bathroom, and he was shipped off to the Black Tower. And you know, one would have thought he would have resented me at the... Not at all. He ended up in the Court of Appeal. I ended up in the Court of Appeal with him, and sat with him. And a nicer man you couldn't. And he, incidentally, was a classmate of mine at law school. Hinkson. Yeah, Hinkson was a classmate. Madam Justice Southern was a classmate. She was the first appointment to the Court of Appeal. First woman appointed to the Court of Appeal. I was second. And Beverly McLaughlin, the Supreme Court of Canada, was second after me to the county court. I was on the court system 8 years before there was another woman appointed. You can imagine what I felt like. I thought, oh my God.
Were you waiting for another one?
I thought I had probably done something that they didn't want another one. You know, I thought, my goodness, I must have.
You must have done something wrong.
I must have done something to tell the powers that be that women really aren't good in the field. You know, don't make good judges. But other than that, but it was logical. There wasn't enough women being graduated from law school. I mean, six of us graduated in 1952. Six women graduated out of that whole class of 116. So you can imagine. And one went into academia, when she went on to get her master's, and the other one didn't practice law. So, you know, there was really, there wasn't many. Now, my understanding is from after the 70s, it started to equalize the graduates.
Is that about in the graduates, yeah.
Yeah. It, so at that time, there weren't enough women to appoint. You know, there was... So it would follow, you know, that they would take a while to get women appointed. But prejudice, no, I can't say as I... But I say maybe some was going on, but I certainly didn't feel any. And maybe it still is some, but I'm... Didn't bother me, nothing affected like that.
You must have learned a lot of law, and it must have been a steep learning curve, and you must have had to have a good track record to keep getting promoted.
You're not just a whistler, because every court was very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember just turning down, when I came to the county court, the very first case that was assigned to me was a jury trial, a conspiracy, and it involved the Filipponis. Now, you probably don't know the Filipponi name, but the Filipponis, I don't know whether the place is still probably going, the Penthouse, the nightclub called the Penthouse, it's on Seymour or down, yeah, it's on probably Seymour where all the nightclubs are. Mind you, I don't go to the nightclubs, but it's called the Penthouse, and had a fair reputation.
There's a book about it, I think, coming
out. Yeah, Filipponis. Yeah. Their family was famous, and they were charged with... you know what? I can't even remember exactly what the charges were, but I know conspiracy to do something or other was involved. I suspect they were doing some illegal activities at the club. I don't know. I can't remember. But anyway, Bill Schultz, who was the chief judge, I went to see him, and I said, you know, chief judge, I'm just at my first trial... And a jury trial, a conspiracy with the Filipponis? I don't think so. I said, I don't think you're doing any favors. It'll be an appeal as sure as, because I know I'll be nervous. I'll make a mistake, and there's no point in not being honest about the situation. I said, I think you should assign that to a far more senior judge. And he said, oh, he says, I'm not even sure how this got assigned this way. Said, by all means, he said. But he said, you know, if you want it, you're welcome to it. In other words, he wasn't taking it away from me, you know, that I was, mm-hmm. He felt I was capable. But I felt that it just would be too much for my first trial. And but the cases were assigned and the list, again, the list was made up and the, You've got a courtroom, whatever you got in there. Supreme Court, the same. There was just an assignment made. There was no picking and choosing. I suspect it's still done that way. Trial coordinators are still assigning cases the same way. Court of Appeal, the panels were organized. Our rota was made up a year ahead. We knew how many panels there were and how many cases there were, and this. They just, you know, one panel were doing criminal, one were doing civil, one would do this. There was no selective, in other words, judge shopping. There used to be some judge shopping in the county court by lawyers, including myself. We had a system of courtroom A, B, C, and D. And the judge, a particular judge... That sort of, by the time I got to the county court, that system was gone. Because what you would stand in line to file your documents, and if you saw that you were going to get the courtroom B stamp and you didn't like the judge in courtroom B, you'd just step out the line. And the guy behind you would get B. And you'd make some excuses to why if you forgot something, and away you'd go, and you'd get back in line and hope that you got A or C or D. Because,
and that's called judge shopping.
Well, we called it judge shopping. It was manipulative as can be, but that was done. Yeah, and I don't know that anybody would admit it. I admit it.
Supposedly, the person who was behind you knew exactly what you were doing.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And believe me, they wouldn't be happy. They wouldn't be happy because they'd have to either step out of line too. And if you were in a hurry, for instance, you could, you know, you could be there all day stepping out of line. So you'd get the odds were against you as to getting it sometime anyway. You may be successful once in stepping out of the line, but you had to step back in to get your documents filed. You didn't get back to go back to the office with your documents not filed. So, you know, the guys in front of you were stepping out too, so you were the next. It's sort of what, you got your turn with courtroom B or C or D or whichever one you didn't like. But we had some very irascible judges, but they were irascible to women and men. You know, we had one fellow, he just didn't like law students, and or say clerks, law clerks, and article students, whatever you want to call them. And he would scream and shout at you, you know, and they delighted. There's one fellow in particular, he delighted in trying to put you on the spot, embarrass you. But this was, he did this as Klein. Klein was treated both equally. We had equality. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, some were just very impatient. The judges nowadays aren't that impatient anymore. They're not that mean, tripping. You know, some were really mean-spirited. Which I don't think goes on now. Certainly not when I can recall. They weren't that way.
How do you keep a good, or maintain a good reputation as a judge, or, well, as a lawyer for that matter?
Well, as a lawyer with appearing in the court, you better be honest, because I can tell you. One or two lawyers that appeared before me were dishonest, and you never forget it. Mm. They never. I think probably one of the, I don't know what your, because I think you teach ethics out here, don't you? I think there's an ethics course, isn't it, of some kind? Well, I can tell you, a lawyer's integrity, honesty is the most important thing, because I can tell you, once you lose it, I can assure you, you do not get it back easily. Judges never trust you again. I came out of the courtroom one time in provincial court, and I walked across the street to go to lunch. Ahead of me was a lawyer who didn't know I was behind, and who was just having himself the greatest laugh on earth because they pulled one over on me. What did they do? These twin brothers switch drivers, and came into court and said to me that, oh no, he wasn't driving. And of course the brother was driving, yeah, switched on me, and I never ever forgot that lawyer. Any time he was appeared after that, he had a tough role with me.
Did he know that?
He didn't know I was bad. Never did, and I never did. I never did. Oh, yes. So I can't stress enough, the lawyer. You know, if you got a problem, don't try to make excuses, and don't try to lie out of a situation.
Did the judges compare notes?
Yes. We particularly once we got premises where we had lounges. Yes, a lot of that done. We did it in provincial court, 2-2 Maine. Certainly we did it in county court. We had more, we had no lounge there, as I recall, but we met in Schultz's office and for coffee in the morning. And yeah. Judges talked a lot, yes.
So if you were
shady in a particular courtroom, believe me, the judges found out. Yes. And it's one of the most difficult things is for judges after to believe a lawyer if they've not told the truth. And it's very difficult to
regain that confidence again. Yes, very definitely. Mm-hmm. And lawyer, yeah, judges talk, no doubt about it. They talk in the lounges, they talk over lunch, they have lunch together. I remember in the county court, when I was in the county court, a group of us went to lunch, same judges, we went to lunch every day at the Georgia Hotel. And we spend our entire lunchtime probably discussing what we were working on in the morning, you know. If it was, it was just, particularly the county court, because Schultz was a, he was not a, we didn't talk sports. Once we got into the other, we often talked much more about different topics, you know, once the court was bigger. But the county court was quite small and quite sort of intimate. And once we merged the, and got into the new building, we had a lounge, and then it was different. We sat around having our lunch, but talked about various things, and of course the weekend football game. The weekend, I had to learn about football, learn about hockey, and these were the kinds of things that they spoke about. Suddenly, you got a bunch of women appointed in the top. You know, the conversation changes completely. Yeah. It's very funny. It's actually quite funny the way it evolves. Because I remember on coming to work on Monday, and I tell you, the football game was discussed, the hockey game was discussed, if there was one, or the golf game on television was discussed. And I was playing golf, so that didn't bother me, but I had to, and I didn't know too much about football at all. I still don't know too much about it, because it wasn't really one of the games that I liked. But you listened, and you know, you just listened, and you joined in with what little knowledge you had, or you asked questions. Yeah. But it changed. Once you got a bunch of women in the club, it changed. The lounge changed.
Did you have to write judgments? Presumably, you did. And the writing, was that a
real problem?
I
didn't save my Supreme Court. I think they're all on microfiche, but I had volumes upon volumes of, because I was on the Supreme Court from 77 to 89 in 11 years. There's a lot of judgments. I have my Court of Appeal judgments at home. I save them, and I don't know, I've got them in binders, and I don't really know why I save them. They're all on somewhere on microfiche or disk or whatever. Particularly on the Court of Appeal, I wrote with difficulty. I'm not a good writer. I'm just simply, I find putting things down in writing, I find it very difficult. I wrote with difficulty. I was on the Supreme Court, and I was quite comfortable there. Well, we had a lot of judgments, but they were different. I always felt if I made a mistake, there was the Court of Appeal, you know, to correct the mistake. But when McEachern asked me to join the Court of to come to the Court of Appeal to join him, I said, no, I don't think I want to move from here. I'm comfortable here. And you know, I write with a lot of difficulty, not like some of the judges. God, they just can write so easily. I said, I write with difficulty. I know what I want to do. I have never had a problem. I've never come out of the courtroom undecided as to what I want to do. I can make up my mind, and a lot of judges can't. A lot of judges are waffling. I never had it. I never had that problem. But to get it on paper in a proper fashion, that was always difficult. And I said, no. I said, I think I'll stay here, because, you know, I find writing very difficult, and I write. I said, literally blood, sweat, and tears. And he looked at me, he just laughed. He said, you don't have to write. All you have to do is agree. I said, yeah, sure, I'll just agree. Because what happened, the week's cases were assigned to the three of us, and the most senior judge who presided assigned the cases out. And some cases, some judges like better than others. So I had a tendency to write the family law ones. I liked those, and I had a tendency to write those. For instance, Newberry, she's an absolute, and Risa Levine at the moment. These two came from financial backgrounds.
God, they just write so simply. I can't believe it. They can write a complicated financial thing, that, and they do it so easily.
Yeah.
Whereas I write with a lot of difficulty. I wrote the judgment in the Sue Rodriguez case.
That was that assisted suicide
20 years ago, and Chief Justice, myself, and Holland Rake were on the and Chief Justice had the habit of, we'd come out of a case, and within a day I'd have a draft on my desk. And I think his psychology, I realized after, his psychology was really, he wanted to put his ideas out there very quickly in the hopes that you'd agree with him. Well, of course, when it arrived, I didn't agree with him. And I emailed him, said, sorry, I can't sign your judgment, your draft. I don't agree with it. And because he was going to grant the application with a massive amount of conditions. And I still, to this day, I still feel the same as I felt that time, that it's a thing that the government has to look at. It's not for the court to decide this issue. I think it's an issue that's beyond the courts. It's a social issue that should be decided by the public. Should be plenty of debate, and then the government should ultimately make the decision on the basis of what the people want. And of course, the government won't do that. That's why we're back in the same thing 20 years later, and we're back now. Now this is going to go to it. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada supported my judgment. I did one phase of it, and Holland Rake did the other. Neither of us agreed with the Chief Justice. He was out on left field, and he was not happy. But that's beside the point. He figured we'd go along with him, and we didn't. Supreme Court of Canada upheld us, but it was a narrow, it was a 5-4 decision. So I suspect the Taylor case, I think it's Taylor the woman, it will go all the way through, because Lynn Smith found for assistance and agreed with it. And the Crown is appealing. And I suspect it'll go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, it'll be interesting what the Supreme Court of Canada will do, because there's a different composition of the Supreme Court of Canada in 20 years. It's a far different composition. Now, whether or not, but my opinion has not changed. I still think the one thing, I never had any difficulty making up my mind. And the other thing is, I'm not shy to say what my opinion is. That's it. Then you know you live or die with what your opinion is, and that's it, my opinion today. I was at a reception, and Joe Arvey came up. He's acting, came up to me and asked me what I would. I said, Joe, you're in the middle of a case. Why do you ask me that? This thing is before the courts. Why would I say what I think? I'm retired now, as what I think is quite unimportant. And I would not discuss it with you. I said, you shouldn't even have asked me. And he was looking for some support, I think. But well, he's got his judgment, and I'll be watching with interest what the Court of Appeal does with it, and what ultimately the Supreme Court of Canada does with it.
You said you make up your mind quite quickly, or.
Once I heard everything that there was to hear, I could usually make up my mind. Yeah.
What? How did you do that? What were the ingredients? Was it in intuition? Was it the arguments?
Well, a lot of times I felt the law was pretty clear, or people were thinking it wasn't clear. I thought it was pretty clear. The other is, if you were depending on witnesses in the trial bench, I don't know, I seem to be able to sort out who was lying and who was telling the truth. You watch body language, you watch all kinds of nervousness, and I know some people will be nervous in any of it, but there's body language that sort of
tells you. Now, you have to be careful, because with native witnesses, we learn very quickly, native witnesses never look, won't look at you. Mm. They're inherently shy. So, whereas another witness that you know is not inherently shy will look down and look away or do anything to not look at you, that's suspicious. But not with a native. You have to be more careful with native witnesses. They may have changed, but certainly in my time, that was one of the things we learned very quickly, because they shy away from authority in any event. You know, they're nervous, they're frightened, and for whatever reasons, you know. But I don't know.
So it was a package of.
It was a variety. It was a variety. It was It was a variety of things that. I often thought about that, because we'd come out, even on the Court of Appeal, we'd come out and say, gee, I don't know what to do about this case. And I'd say, well, I know what to do about it, but how do you put it in writing? That's the point, you know. So that's where my difficulty was in writing, no doubt about it.
So translating
what I had in my mind, and translating that to play, I don't know, maybe there's something in my brain maybe there's something missing up there, but I had a difficulty with that right through. I don't apologize. I don't write the length, and I never ever wrote the length. I always remember Angelo Branca was on the Court of Appeal at the time, and I was on the trial bench, and I remember him saying, Pat, keep judgments short. Every page you write for sure will produce another ground of appeal. I remember him so clearly telling me that. He said, you'll say too much somewhere. And I remember this in jury trials. I came out of a jury trial one night. It was later at night. We were having, the jury was in deliberating. And I came out, I was out sitting in my chambers, and next to my chambers was a Judge McKay, Harry McKay, who was he was very good at jury trials, very, very good. And I said, you know why I'm here? I said, what are you doing? I said, well, I have to come back. I said, the jury's asked a question. And I said, frankly, I don't really know how to answer that without getting into an awful lot of detail. Oh, he said, don't do that, that's disaster. Let's have the question. So he looked at the question and he said, you go back in and you answer that in about 6 words. Nothing more. That's all they need to know. They're not looking for a long explanation. They're looking for guidance. And guidance is a short answer, and that they can, otherwise you start giving them another story, that just doesn't do. And I wrote mostly shorter. I try to confine myself to, I seldom wrote over 30 pages. Yes, I had to, at times you had to go beyond, but I tried to keep it within that. People have often told me that I write clearly. I do, because I write short sentences. Nothing bothers me more when I'm reading something and a sentence is a whole paragraph. I did a commission, you'll see in my CV, I did a commission on the women in prisons. And I had, my commission counsel was John Hall, who's on the Court of Appeal and just about ready to retire, I think. And Anne Rounthwaite. Was it Anne or was her sister, was also on. Anyway, she was a junior commission counsel. And when we came time to write the report, I said, well, let's break it into certain parts. I will write this. Anne, you've done the most research on the what labor laws were involved, the union, etc., that area. And I gave John another part to write. And then I wrote my part. And when the three pieces came,
Anne's and my writing was fairly close. We had an editor then. We decided. I had a. I said, "There's got to be somebody that's got to put this together," because John wrote with these incredible long sentences, and I wrote with short sentences. I said, "You know, John, anybody reading this report, there is no way that they're going to figure one person wrote this report. This has got to be put together in a show. I'm sorry, but it just got to be put together. And the only way we're going to do that is we've got to have somebody, an editor, to get the styles together." And at the end of the day, it came out pretty good. You know, even with three people writing certain sections of it. I've always had a problem writing. I think that was one of the problems I had at university with exams. If they were, if an exam was a short, like for instance mathematics, I had no problem with mathematics. You know, I had no problem with the psychology courses. But when it came to English, and I had to write long answers, I had a problem. No doubt about it. And but I don't know why. I must have somewhere during my lower education neglected to listen or do something that I didn't do. I don't know. Because what allows you see, for instance, you write that beautiful book. I ask you, how do you put that together?
That's right.
That's an incredible. I look at that with just an incredible, brilliant piece of work. They say there's no way I could write a book. I just can't. I just couldn't do it. Oh, I can. I can talk forever, but
well, it was a lot. Lots of different files and keeping them all up.
Yes.
In here,
yes.
So.
Exactly. And that's of course was the. For instance, jury charges. Some judges go on for days. I never went on for days. I made myself an outline. This is what I've got to cover. This is my outline. And then I try to fill in that outline with everything I had to say. But instead of saying it in a paragraph, say it in one sentence. And I didn't have any problems with jury charges that went on forever. I just didn't. And I enjoyed jury trials. I could sit up all practically all night. If you were out of town on an assize and you wanted to get home, you would sit up till 2, 3, and 4 in the morning to get your jury charge together so that you could go the next morning, give it to the jury, and hopefully get home by the weekend. But because, you know, spending your weekend in Connell or some other small town wasn't necessarily the most agreeable, I would say. But, yes, I had a problem with writing.
Obviously an astute, intuitive sense of the...
Yes. And what I had, once we got to the Court of Appeal particularly, we were then had law clerks. Those came into being in about 1978, I think, was our. I got my first law clerk, 78, 79. And I had some incredibly good editors that could swing a paragraph right around, because they got two instructions: don't change my result, and don't change my reasoning. You can't do that. That's fiddling with my judgment. You can't do that. But if you can make it read more easily, fine. And I had some very good students that were very good at editing, very good. Only one student, and I see her. She's in town. I was visiting with her in London. She's in London. And she's still working as a lawyer, and I was just in London in May, and I was visiting with her, and I said to Lana, "Do you remember the time that you took my judgment? That you took a draft of a judge that came from another judge?"
and you said to me, you went to the other judge, you said, this is not correct in law. Do you remember that? No, she says, I don't remember that. Well, I said, I remembered very clearly because a judge came to me and says, your law clerk came, and she was a thin little thing, you know, that would be standing in front. I could just see her standing in front of this tall judge and telling him he's wrong, you know, in his conclusion. But he ultimately had to agree that he was, and he came to me and said, you know, she's absolutely right. I looked up the law, and she's absolutely right. I'd have been embarrassed as could be because I was wrong. I said, well, I said, she's pretty bright. I said, she's caught me on one or two things, and I've had to go and I've disagreed too, and then I've gone and secretly checked, and she was right. So, yeah, I've had to. But if you had a good, real good clerk, and I say I had some really good clerks, I still meet with mine every year. We have a reunion. I still get anywhere from, depending on who's in town and who's available, because, you know, my first ones were 1978, but those that are from 1980 and there, sometimes I get 10, sometimes I get 12, sometimes I get 14. And we meet for a brunch at my place and discuss old days, old, you know, their clerking days, and because, you know, clerks discuss judges too. Not just judges discuss clerks. Believe me, they discuss judges too.
What do clerks do?
Research. Research. Not all judges. Their law clerks didn't all edit. Mine did my editing, and I was happy to have that. Mostly research, and they did preliminary memos on cases that we, particularly in the Court of Appeal, for instance, every case had a preliminary memo on it, and that gave a very brief fact pattern, and then what the issues are, and what the judgment said. So if you had a massive number of cases, you at least had an idea. And my approach was, and one or two of the Court of Appeal judges come up to me and thank me, because I said to them, look, you'll never be able to read everything that comes to you. That's just not possible, because you may have two stacks of books this high and transcripts and God knows I'll tell you, but read the preliminary memo so that in your mind you get what the basic fact pattern and what the issues are. Then when you read, you can read with some intelligence. Then I said, read the judgment, read the factums, and then if you've got time, look at the, if it's a contract case, certainly look at the contract. If it's some other a criminal case and there's a particular issue, try and find transcripts that cover that particular issue, or motions, or whatever they are, if they're grounds of appeal are that the judge ruled incorrectly on certain motions of admittance of admission of evidence, for instance. Get to that, because it said you'll not be able to read everything. There's just no way. And that's the way I approached it, because the Court of Appeal, you feel swamped when you first go there. And they have this procedure of this wagon arrives with all the files on it, and they dump all the cases for the week in your office. And you look at that and you just think, geez, I don't know whether I can handle much more of this, you know, but you seem to plow through it. Yeah, it's a massive amount. A Court of Appeal is a massive amount of work, massive amount of reading. And even if you read quickly, you can't read it all, no matter how hard you try.
I'm just thinking of the difference between my work and yours, because your admiration for my book there.
Fantastic.
But you know what I do is I try to take a little and kind of stretch it out into a book, and with something like logging, that it's not a little, it's a lot.
So it's a lot.
Makes a book, but it seems what you do is the opposite.
Just yes.
You take all this,
and
all the documents,
you got to condense it.
And condense it.
You see, lot of times, the Supreme Court, well, Chris, what has happened, I think, with the judgments, they're getting longer. Now, I know that the issues that the Charter has, you know, created problems, I've already said that, but the Supreme Court of Canada is writing long. They're writing long judgments. And, of course, judges now seem to think they have to write 80 to 100 to 200 pages. They don't. They simply don't. I mean, even law students. How have law students got time to read all these judgments that are pages and pages and pages long? And a lot of it is fill-in, just to be a long judgment. And there's no need for all that. There's no need for it. You can, you know. But that's the present style. You write long. Did I read where somebody wrote 364 pages or something? Somebody, what is that long judgment? There's one judgment recently, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was over 300 pages.
Where is that coming from? Is it an academic influence?
I think they're writing, what they're trying to do is they're writing for, instead of writing, a lot of writing, Professor, is for the next court. In other words, if it's appealed. Let's see, if we got everything. Instead of writing for the litigant, who's supposed to understand his judgment. Litigants don't understand often what's happened to their cases. And the trick is to get the result right up front. So the litigant looks at it, knows what has happened. Did I win this or did I lose it? And then write why. You know, that this conclusion is reached. You find a lot of them will start and go right through, and then in the end, somewhere down the end, you find what they concluded. That's not the style you're supposed to. When we went to the there's a judgment writing course. The judges, I'm not sure where they still go, but I know that I went. And they teach you to write these shorter judgments. But I don't know what the inference is. No, I think they write, but I do know this, that they write there's a lot of writing for the next court, rather than writing for the litigant to understand what's happened.
So it's almost a fear-based...
A lot of times, I agree with you, yes, what will the Court of Appeal think? Well, I never ever thought that. I thought, I want Mr. and Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones to understand what's happened to them and why. If the Court of Appeal doesn't agree with me, so be it, you know. It's not a very, shall we say, brilliant or not rocket science approach, but that was my approach. Mm-hmm. And that's best I can. Mm-hmm. What was, again, I guess it was an accumulation, sort of all kinds of factors that... get into that picture, but I don't know why suddenly everybody's writing, and they write, they do write incredibly long judgments. Yeah.
I'm a bit concerned about time, Graham. Are we still?
Yeah, it's 4:15. Are we?
Should probably, but can I ask?
I
you,
can go on a little further if my car is safe in the parking.
Well, they should go on for another little while. I've got to be somewhere at 5.
Well, that's fine.
Well, we can always meet again. But
we can meet again.
But I wanted to ask if there were who we should talk to, who else we should talk to.
Else should you talk to?
Yeah.
Certainly, I think you should certainly try to talk to Owen Dolan. I'm not sure about John Montgomery, but certainly Owen should be spoken to because, and I think he's, and Dolores Holmes is a good one to talk to. Now she lives over in Deep Cove. I'm not sure how her physical health is. Owen I know was all right the last time I saw him, but I'm not sure about Dodie. But she would be one to talk to. Trying to think who else is around that might be of assistance in this early. Trouble is, you know, memories fade like. I believe me, I was from the time that your email arrived, I was trying to think back, you know, and try to. But it's very, very difficult.
What about the instructors? Have you kept in touch with any of them, the professors?
Well, there isn't any around anymore. I don't think there's any around anymore.
Bourne, of course, is just...
Bourne was the last, I think. Now, Ballam may be in still in Calgary. I don't know, but he's writing books. He was into contracts. Now, the guest lecturers, Vic Dreyer, I know, came up to do evidence. I was on the bench with him. I know he's gone. Let me see, Alan McFarland, Mr. Justice McFarland. Alan McFarland is still alive, lives over in Shawnigan. I think he was a graduate of here. I'm trying to think of our retired lunches for judges.
Right.
We've got to, and I'm trying to remember who comes. Mike Goldie's just passed away, because I know I'm going to his celebration for life, and on the 17th of August he was on the bench with me. Ted Hinkson's gone. Jim McDonald is gone. Bay Wallace. Now, he's in his 90s, but Bay would be one of them, I would think, was probably one of the most, and Bay was in the services as well.
B-A-E.
His son, Brian, I think it's Brian Wallace, is a lawyer. I know he lives somewhere in West Vancouver. He's still around. I'm trying to think of who I was on the bench with. Madam Justice Mary Southern, but I'm not sure that Mary would. She's not really. She might. She might be.
We have written to her, and I don't think we've heard back.
You won't, probably. Wait, how long have you? How long ago?
Well, it was an email. Alumni people here have allowed us to use that.
Yes, yes.
And it was about a week or two ago.
Well, give it a bit of time, but Mary's not really, she doesn't really come to any of the legal functions or anything. She doesn't. She's not. From the point of retiring, I think the last time I saw Mary, we had a court of appeal dinner, and she came to that, the women. Trying to think. I have to think about it, and I could, if I think about anybody else, I could email
you. Email, and we've got these, I mean, there's these really high profile people who we want to try, the Mike Harcourts and Kim Campbells, and we're after them. But I think we should talk again, because I've got on your CV and on this.
Well, I'm in town all summer.
Well, that would be great.
I'm in town all summer. Give me a couple of days' notice, because I
I'm a baseball fan, for instance. Yeah. I'm a very much a baseball fan. I go to the Canadians games, and I buy my ticket, buy a package of tickets, and so I go to all the games. But I'm in town. I'm away from the 7th to the 13th of September. I'm away. I'm up in Kelowna.
Well, in the middle week of August, we're both here, the 13th to the 17th. And
I'm
I know
here.
there's one or two gaps, spots there. Where
well, it's you give me a couple of days' notice,
okay.
Doctor, and I can I'll accommodate you further.
Thank you.
Yeah, as long as you arrange my parking.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that worked out, the parking.
Well, I said my bad knee doesn't sometimes limits some of my activity, but yes, no, I can
okay.
I can help you further.
Because we've got there's a lot here that we haven't.
Well, I probably have spoken too long on useless stuff.
I know it's been a very instructive for me because I've learned a lot. About what judges do and how they make decisions.
Well, they often judges often, the Court of Appeal, you sit and meet very often, sometimes not, but very often you can sit and meet and talk about things or talk about a particular point, see if you can find an area to where you can agree, you know, if there's somebody that doesn't agree. Although you sometimes find there's certain judges that don't want to meet. They don't, there's personalities involved, yeah. You know, you got to remember there's personalities involved, and it's amazing. Now I tell you who's still around, but I'm not sure who's Lambert. He's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Lives in Penticton, I believe.
What's his other?
Douglas. I'm not sure. Who knows exactly where he is, but he's still around, Lambert. And I'm not sure whether he was a graduate of this university. I honestly don't know. But he certainly is of the older group. So you see, the longer it goes, you're doing it before everybody's out of the picture. But if you're going to be somewhere at 5,
yes,
you
I
better get
be
on your horse.
I tracked, but